Inga mana, inga reo, inga ta wira pumanua, ro rakatira ma, tenakoto, tenakoto, tenatato katoa. Good evening. My name is Harlene Hain, and I have the great privilege of being the Vice Chancellor here at the University of Otago. And on behalf of the university, it is my great pleasure to welcome you to this inaugural professorial lecture for Professor David O'Hare. On behalf of the university, I would like to warmly welcome the staff and students who are here with us this evening. And I would also like to welcome members of the general public, who I know often use this inaugural professorial lecture slot in the week as part of their own lifelong learning. But last but not least, I'd like to welcome members of David's family who are here with us tonight. So his wife, Diane, and his son, Callum, and his daughter, Kirsty, are here. And the O'Hare family actually has a very long-standing relationship with the University of Otago. Diane recently retired from her position in the psychology department, and both Callum and Kirsty are proud graduates. And in fact, Kirsty is still a student here at the University of Otago, studying her PhD in the psychology department. There are other members of David's extended family and his friends who are also here in the audience this evening, and on behalf of the university, I would like to warmly welcome all of you to this fantastic event. Now, as many of you know, I always feel an immense sense of pride at these inaugural professorial lectures because I know exactly how much work it takes to get promoted to professor at the University of Otago. But tonight, I'm particularly proud because David O'Hare is a long-standing member of my home department, the Department of Psychology, and he's been my colleague for more than 20 years. Over that period, I've had the opportunity to personally watch David's commitment to teaching, his commitment to research, and his outstanding service. By way of example, one of his books, Flight Deck Performance, The Human Factor, has been reprinted 5 times. According to the referees that we consulted when we were considering David's promotion to professor, this book has been popular because it is useful. And it's useful because it teaches students basic psychological principles and their practical relevance to aviation. David's work has received support from NASA in the past, and his findings are often cited in transportation safety reports. In terms of teaching, David has been solely responsible for curricular development of cognitive ergonomics in the psychology department. And outside of the psychology department, he's contributed to postgraduate courses in aviation medicine and occupational health. But David has also made his mark well beyond the university. He's a full member of the International Society of Air Safety Investigators, and he's an approved pilot licensing examiner in aviation human factors. His research on decision-making has been extended across a wide range of professions, including firefighting, industrial power controllers, outdoor adventures, and soccer. The WeatherWise courses that David developed for use by the U.S. Federal Aviation Administration and other civil aviation authorities has actually been instrumental in reducing accidents and in saving lives. So, David, as your Vice Chancellor, I would like to congratulate you on your very well-earned promotion to professor. I would now like to call on Professor Keith Hunter, who will tell us just a little bit more about David's academic journey. Nō reira, tēnā koutou, tēnā koutou, tēnā tātou katoa.
Kia ora tātou, and welcome everybody, and thank you, Vice Chancellor. This is one of the highlights of my job as Pro Vice Chancellor, introducing new professors to you in their inaugural lecture. So David was born in Kabul in Afghanistan, and he spent a number of years in various Middle Eastern countries, including Egypt, Turkey, and Iran. But he then went to the UK for his secondary education in South London. After that, he went to Exeter University, where he got a first-class honours degree in psychology and stayed on to complete his PhD. And he was then offered a lectureship at Lancaster University, and it was there in the Lake District where he first learned to fly, first of all gliders, and then later obtaining a private pilot's licence for powered aircraft. And that must have been a significant period of his life because he's ended up devoting his academic career to understanding aviation. He came to New Zealand in 1982 after telling his mother that he'd be away for no more than 12 months and is still here. And he carried out the huge job of overhauling the entire second year lab program in psychology and quite a lot of lab classes and the basic structure of that new course that he introduced remain at the present day. He attended a course in aircraft accident investigation at Cranfield University in the UK, and that really started him off on a program research into human performance in aviation and in aviation accidents. And as Harleen said, he has worked extensively with groups such as the New Zealand Office of Air Accident Investigation, the United States FAA, and has received considerable funding from groups such as the US FAA and NASA. A few years ago, he was using a flight simulator to help a clinical psychologist colleague to treat clients who had crippling flight anxiety. And the idea was to expose them to progressively worse flight conditions in a simulator. And so after he'd done an initial flight in good weather, he set up a second session with a particular client involving quite a bit of strong wind and rain, and he tested it out and then stopped and got the client on board. But unfortunately, the simulator reset itself. And so after getting less than halfway down the runway, he realised that something was not right. And he probably should have aborted the flight, but he decided that that might have made the client worse, so he didn't. But eventually, they limped over the upper branches of the trees at the end of the runway and made it away safely. At the end of that, David says he was a nervous wreck, and the anxious client seemed to be fine. Outside the university, David is noted for his lifelong passion for football, that is, soccer. He's a supporter of Chelsea and a former player, and in more recent years he's become a referee, and in fact he's obtained the top level qualifications in soccer refereeing and refereed at the Southern Premier League level here for a number of years. So David, I would add to the Vice-Chancellor my congratulations on your thoroughly deserved promotion, and I would invite you to present your inaugural lecture.
Gosh, well, thank you so much. a bit worrying seeing so many people here. I just kind of feel I should start with a bit of a disclaimer. Just to get some things out of the way. No, I don't know where MH370 went. but I do know that we're all fascinated by this idea of what happened in the cockpit that night. What were the actions of the crew? Were they bravely fighting some unexpected conflagration that had erupted underneath the cockpit? Or was there some more sinister kind of grappling going on? I've spent the last 30 years trying to understand some aspects of pilot behaviour, and what I want to do tonight is to give you a brief insight, a little glimpse into the cockpit. Now, as has been said, I have my own personal history with aviation. Early on, I actually wanted to be an airline pilot, and so that's why the BOAC Comet is there. I actually flew on one of those, but not as pilot in command, obviously. I was working my way through the pilot selection process until I got to a fixed roadblock, which was hay fever. And if you suffer badly from hay fever, you are not allowed to have a commercial airline transport pilot's license. So my dreams were dashed at that point, and fortunately, I took the path of taking a psychology degree and having a wonderful life in that regard. I did make the mistake of telling this anecdote to a second year class once, and at the end of year course evaluations I've got, clearly Professor O'Hare did not want to be here as he is a failed airline pilot. Anyway, I had the good fortune to fly all of these types here as pilot in command at one point or another. Now, as this is a photograph of me around the age 9 or 10 or so, and as you've heard, I had the great good fortune to be born in Kabul, Afghanistan, and you can imagine what a boon that's been to international travel. But the point, we're going to pick up the story here. I was around nine or 10 years of age, living in Iran. And for those of you still harboring a lingering confusion between Iran and Iraq, Iran's the one with the weapons of mass destruction. Anyway, approaching the age of about 10, a very important event occurs in the British educational calendar. It's called the 11 plus exam. And so my family and I transferred back to the UK in order that I could sit this examination. The 11 plus was a screening, nationwide screening, culling test, if you like, that determined really your entire future. And it was part IQ test, part mathematics, English achievement kind of a test. And basically it divided you into academic types or non-academic types, thinkers and doers. And this creates a dichotomy that I abhor, really, that, you know, clever people don't need to be practical and practical people shouldn't be clever. And I question that, and it leads to all sorts of, to my mind, pointless arguments about applied research versus pure research and so forth. So I don't think this is inherently unhelpful. Now, I'm pretty sure this is where J.K. Rowling got this from. It's exactly what it is. So you do this, you go into the sorting hat decides whether you're not worthy, in which case you go slithering off to secondary modern school to do woodwork and cookery and things like that. On the other hand, if it deems you worthy, then you go, and I can't make a verb out of Gryffindor, so you go to grammar school anyway, to get a traditional academic education in maths, science and history. Now, on this particular day, for reasons unbeknownst to me, the hat smiled especially favourably on me, and it deemed me worthy of getting a state scholarship to attend an independent, fee-paying private school, a kind of minor public school, where I enjoyed excellent academic facilities, staff mainly from Oxford and Cambridge, excellent school facilities, and so forth. In addition to the traditional grammar school education of math, science and history, you've got Latin, compulsory rugby, and occasional beatings by the headmaster. Now, I'd like to think this early success didn't go to my head, but for some... but for some reason, I seem to have turned into an old coward at this point. Anyway, I made it through secondary education and went on to Exeter University. I had six very, very happy years at Exeter, so you'd be pleased that I grew out of being Noel Coward, but I seem to have grown into some sort of... this is my skinny latte French metrosexual phrase. Now, the moment of epiphany occurred at the end of my time at Exeter, following my oral, which was the late, very famous Hans J. Eysenck, who examined my PhD. And at the end of it, it was a fairly perfunctory oral, I can't remember a great deal about it, but at the end of it, I remember Eysenck shaking my hand. I don't remember his words, the literal words, but what the gist of what he said to me was that he was congratulating me on producing such an epically irrelevant thesis. and this again relates to this idea that there's this dichotomy between there's clever people and there's practical people, and if you're a clever person, you shouldn't be doing anything remotely practical. So it was clever. You show your cleverness by doing something completely irrelevant and basically pointless. We see a sort of something similar in these days, reflected in the television's The Big Bang Theory, and you probably most of you know the dynamics of this, where Sheldon, the theoretical physicist, looks down on Leonard, who's just a practical experimental physicist because he kind of does stuff, and of course they both look down with disdain on Howard, who's just has an MIT degree in engineering, and he's obviously the practical person. So you get this hierarchy of, like, you know, I'm clever, so I look down on people who actually can do things. And I think this is a very damaging philosophy, and I think it affected the kind of learning that I was exposed to during my university career. I mean, I had a very standard degree training, a good degree training in many respects. We studied perception, psychophysics, memory, learning, and all these things. What we didn't study was what at that time was the burgeoning cognitive revolution. And this was the whole growth of cognitive psychology and cognitive science that grew out into a large degree from psychologists getting their hands dirty and getting down and being drafted in during the Second World War or at the end of the Second World War to help solve problems of people and systems. So Donald Broadbent, one of the most famous cognitive psychologists, he was working on problems of aircrew communication between, you know, five crew members on the flight deck of a bomber. Other people like Paul Fitz were solving problems of pilot behavior. Why would pilots raise the undercarriage by mistake when they were actually on the runway and so forth? And I think not only is this an example of useful application, but it works the other way too. We get much better theory if we tackle complex real-world issues, then we improve our theory as well, and Broadbent's work demonstrates that perfectly. Now, I got to New Zealand in 1982, and as you will know, at that point, New Zealand was in the midst of intense debates about the Erebus tragedy. Now, impressed on me how aviation-oriented New Zealand was. Everybody knew a pilot or knew somebody who knew a pilot or was in some way connected with this case. And I think comments have been kind of festering within me for the last 4 years or so, and I was really looking for a new direction. And I guess that's why I literally found a new direction and came all the way to New Zealand and started to kind of reinvent myself and think more about the kinds of things I really wanted to do. Now, at this point, as most of you probably know, the basic background to Erebus, on the one hand, we have Ron Chippendale, the Chief Inspector of Air Accidents, whose basic report basically suggested that the crew had made a essentially reckless decision to ignore the risks and to descend the DC-10 low. What's the purpose of the flight was to do some sightseeing. The crew knew that the weather was looking dodgy, but they decided that people had come all this way to see Antarctica, so they would take them down anyway and have a look. On the other hand, again, as most of you know, Captain Gordon Vetti, who was a colleague of Jim Collins, the pilot of the fated flight, himself a DC-10, senior DC-10 captain, didn't buy this idea at all. And Gordon set about finding out for himself what else could have been behind this. And he worked with people in the Auckland Psychology Department and elsewhere, and his theory basically was that the crew failed to perceive critical cues that would have told them that it was possible to have a mountain ahead of you in Antarctica and yet not be able to see it. The crew had no training in Antarctic flying. They had no experience of flying in Antarctica. It was their first ever trip down there. So on the one hand, we've got kind of reckless risk-taking. On the other hand, we've got misperception, lack of expertise in flying in that kind of environment, inability to distinguish the critical cues. And this fascinated me, and I thought, this is what I want to do. But I don't know anything about it. I don't need training in it, so I have to learn something. So I started teaching myself. And I thought, just teaching yourself lots and lots of unrelated facts is a bit pointless, so it'd be a good idea to shape this learning into the form of a book. So I decided to write a book. So I did. Now, it's all very well writing a book, but then you have to... Something then has to happen. So I then made one of those life-changing decisions. Now, this being New Zealand in the 1980s, it's really not very hard to find out where anybody lives, so I was able to track down Gordon Vetti and send a copy of my manuscript to him. I thought, this is a person that I admire. I love what he's done in connection with Erebus. I'll see what he thinks, and does this seem like a good idea? And it all could have ended there, and we wouldn't be having this conversation now. But it didn't. Gordon responded enthusiastically to my manuscript. By this time, he'd already published Impact Erebus, of course. So not many of you will know that Gordon worked on a second Impact Erebus 2, which I was involved in as well, but it never did see the light of day, unfortunately. Anyway, so Gordon got back to me and said, yes, this is very exciting and promising, and he thought there was something in this. And did I mind, but he'd sent the manuscript on to somebody he'd come across during his researches, and this was Professor Stan Roscoe. Professor Stan Roscoe was the most eminent authority in aviation human factors then. He was head of the Aviation Research Laboratory at the University of Illinois. And Stan read the manuscript and kindly saw at least some merit in it. Clearly, he realised it wasn't the finished product. So Stan, there's inevitably going to be puns in a talk about aviation, took me under his wing and mentored me over the rest of his life to turn my stumbling prose attempts into a workable and finished book. It was that one which I remain proud. Both Gordon and Stan remain good friends. They both took me fishing, even though I don't like fishing. and both have now sadly passed away. Okay, I've written a book, so now I've got to start doing something. So I wanted to begin a research program into aviation human factors. So one place to begin is with aircraft accident reports. I mean, there's a lot of information out there that's freely available if you choose to study it. So as the first study, I began to look into the causes of aircraft crashes. This involved a large amount of time spent in dusty warehouses in Petone, where it turns out the air accident officers' records are stored, courtesy of Ron Chippendale. And I have to say, although it might have been viewed as I was aligned with Chippendale's nemesis, Vetti, Ron was unfailingly civil and helpful to me throughout his entire life. So we started coding about 600 air crashes. It's not difficult. It sounds like a large number. There's over 100 a year in New Zealand. 100 a year reported air crashes. Surprisingly, some 10 or 15% of air crashes don't actually get reported. I think that sounds unlikely, but it's true. Anyway, there's plenty of air crashes to look at. And we just started with a simple, basic classification scheme. We were just interested in whether the sources of these accidents was primarily perceptual, as Vetti suggested with Erebus, decisional, as Chippendale suggested with Erebus, or the result of some sort of action errors when pilots inadvertently retracting one piece of equipment rather than another. Now, even with a simple classification like this, you do find something quite interesting. If you look at the minor crashes, the fender benders, if you will, the majority of these are action errors of misaligning something, selecting the wrong control, things of that nature. But when you look at those accidents that end really badly in serious injury or fatalities, then the picture is clearly different. There is a preponderance of decisional cognitive kinds of failures in those accidents. So there's a separate origins to these two types of accidents. Those of you who work in any form of safety will probably be familiar with this safety pyramid, and then it's the classic received wisdom in the field. And it just shows that behind every significant accident, there are less serious accidents, and then a whole much larger number of adverse events and unsafe actions and so forth. So you get this pyramid shape. Now, our findings would suggest a slightly different, a slightly more complex picture, if you like. So there's Bird's pyramid in the middle. And it's clear from what I've said to you and from other work that this pyramid has to be much fatter and broader for action errors. There's likely to be very many more of those before you end up with a significant fatal accident. On the other hand, if you look at decision-making, decisional errors, it's likely that these are likely much more likely to have severe consequences, and so that there is a much fewer to one relationship when we talk about decision errors. So we learned a little bit about the relationship between preceding events, precursor events, and safety. Now, as I say, that was an incredibly simplistic kind of approach, so we wanted to go back and do this again, but look at the decision-making cognitive errors in more detail. So we went back and tackled another 729 accidents using this scheme. Now, the most interesting thing, again, we compare the minor crashes, but when we contrast those with the serious and fatal ones, what really stands out here is the preponderance of goal selection errors. So a goal selection error for a pilot is flying towards deteriorating weather. There are a number of goals you could pursue at this point. You could continue the flight, you could reverse the flight 180 degrees, you could land immediately, you could divert somewhere else. Continuing the flight into the adverse weather in many cases results in tragedy. For the students amongst you, a goal selection error would be there's a big exam coming up tomorrow and you decide to go and have a few drinks tonight or attend a party. That's choosing the wrong goal for the circumstances. So given that we now know that a specific kind of decisional question, choosing the wrong goal, is so important, then we decided to start looking specifically at these kinds of errors. So at the outset of a flight, the weather might look pretty nice. Although this image is a bit dark, it's just the contrast, I think. It's a nice day. There are clouds, but they're just fluffy cumulus floating around. And there's a fairly high cloud base, lots of visibility. Perfect day to go flying. You set off on your 200 or 300 mile cross-country flight, and somewhere along the way, the weather changes. Now we've got stratiform clouds, we've got lowering cloud base, we've got much more threatening kinds of conditions. So we want to look at the decisions that pilots make in these situations. Here's a flight, not entirely hypothetical, from Queenstown to Taree, one that I've made myself. Suppose you took off from Queenstown and got over the Kawarau Gorge and ran into some bad weather. At that point, it seems very easy to turn around, head back to Queenstown, 5 minutes away, put your wheels on the ground, go and have a cup of coffee, wait and see what happens. What happens if you come across the same weather much further on, just as you're getting close to your goal at Taree? Well, I don't have to make this a hypothetical because this exactly happened to me. And I was bringing some people back from the AWCBR conference. We ran into some unexpectedly poor weather over the Rock and Pillars. And I didn't turn back to Queenstown. I thought, can't go over it, can't go under it, must go round it then. So I took a very long detour around the whole Rock and Pillars and managed to find my way back onto the Taree eventually, which was lucky. Now, this suggests that there are some psychological pressures that's come to bear at this later point in the flight that don't operate early on in the flight. So Douglas Owen and I decided to start looking at this. So we took some New Zealand air crash data, and from the lat and long information, turns out trigonometry was useful after all. We calculated the exact distances that these crashes had occurred. And it seemed to us that if there was something in pilots being driven by psychological forces, then if we took an example of accidents that couldn't possibly be due to psychological forces, like engine failures, then this should show a different pattern, a different distribution of distances into the flight. And indeed, that's exactly what we found. Engine failures occurred on average 73 nautical miles, or about 60% of the way into these flights, whereas the goal selection error, making the decision to push on and continue with a somewhat more risky decision occurred much later in the flight, almost three quarters of the way through the flights. Could be argued that, of course, maybe you only get poor weather later in the flight because it's more like what you anticipated and forecast at the outset. Okay. Richard Batt and I looked at a large number of cases from Australia. This time we compared events where there had been a crash due to this goal selection error of pushing on when you shouldn't versus successful weather avoidance cases. So cases where the pilots had successfully turned around and gone back to the point of departure or made a precautionary landing somewhere beneath them, something of that nature. And what we found was that two-thirds of the weather-related crashes attributable to pilots pushing on into poor conditions occurred in the latter part of the flight, tending towards the last third of the flight, whereas two-thirds of the successful weather actions took place in the first part of the flight. So again, it's not just about where you run into the weather, there's something else. There's some psychological underpinnings to this. We thought we should have a look at this in a simulated environment as well. We have a flight simulator. It's pretty basic. It's a fiberglass cab with a projector that produces the outside visual image, some LCD displays that drive the instrument displays and so forth. Thanks, Jason. This is the scenery. It looks pretty darn good, actually. This is just... it's Microsoft Flight Simulator plus some scenery packages developed by New Zealand developers, and that's, I'm sure most of you can recognise that as Lake Hayes looking back towards the airport at Queenstown. That's a fairly convincing representation. When we put pilots through this sort of exercise in the simulator, we could obviously design our flight so that the adverse weather could either appear early or later in the piece. When it appeared early, only 18% of pilots would choose to continue. When those same weather conditions occurred later in the flight, now half of the pilots continued on and half back. So we've definitely got a phenomenon here. There is something to be explained that contributes to pilots undoing. Question is, what is it? So, three lines of converging evidence. We've got evidence from studying accident records, both here in Australia, and our own flight simulator data. Now, if you remember what I said at the start of the talk about Erebus, we have Chippendale talking about misjudgment of risks or unwisely accepting a risk, versus Vetti's argument that no, it's people lacking the skill in identifying the relevant cues. Either of these could be responsible for the phenomenon that we're observing here. Now, this is just the only excursion in the entire talk into some background theory. This is a diagram that summarizes Tversky and Kahneman's prospect theory. Kahneman won a Nobel Prize subsequently in economics, because there are Nobel Prizes in psychology. And this curve summarizes a huge amount of research that's been done into human behavior involving taking risks or gambles. And just the only thing I want you to get out of this is to look on the right-hand side. Here's a kind of utility curve. It shows diminishing marginal utility. Obviously, the 10th ice cream is generally a little less pleasurable than the first one was. The dotted lines show, let's say, for example, the value that you experience from, say, $100. And you might say, well, isn't that obvious? It's $100. Well, depends how much money you've got. I mean, for most starving students in here, $100 has very high value to them. If you're Donald Trump, $100 has very little value at all. So it kind of depends. But the important thing, and the thing I want you to see here, is if we look down the other side of the graph where we talk about losses, this curve is very steep. A $100 loss is extremely painful to us. The magnitude of pain that we experience with a $100 loss is much greater than the magnitude of the joy we gain from a $100 gain. And the significance of this is that in order to avoid that pain of that loss, we will take an unwise gamble. Most of you would sit on $100 for sure rather than gamble on a coin toss for $200 or nothing. On the other hand, most of you who I say, I'm going to take $100 from you, but we'll do double or quits. If you get heads, you have to give me $200 now. But if you get tails, then you give me nothing. Everybody takes the gamble. The pain of that certain loss is so aversive, people will take a gamble in order to avoid it. And if we think of our flight decision-making in these terms, here's this point in the flight, later in the flight. There are some cast-iron certainties in this situation. You've spent a lot of fuel, you've spent a lot of money, you've spent a lot of time. There is a risk involved in continuing. You might not make it, but you probably will. The theory that I've just explained predicts strongly that we will be risk-seeking here, and we will tend to take the gamble, and that's what our accident data was showing us. Suppose we turn it around the other way, and suppose we said, well, maybe if pilots thought about this whole problem differently, in other words, think about gains and think about losses. If at this same point you think, what would I gain? What are the certainties that I can be sure of if I put the plane down now or turn back? Well, you certainly get your plane, you know, back on the ground safely, and you can have a beer. Pilots are very motivated by beers. Risk aversion that we get when people are contemplating gains predicts that in this situation, if you get pilots to think of it in this way, they will choose the certainty and they will be more likely to consequently act safely and take a precautionary landing. So we did a hypothetical just a study of hypothetical choices, and as you can see, we found quite clearly that if you could get pilots and frame the problem in terms of gains rather than losses, you get a reversal of behavior. And this has been found in many other areas, especially in medicine. 90% chance of survival of the operation, 10% chance of death in the operation, quite different kinds of things psychologically. So this has an impact on our pilots. The other alternative is a cue perception one. Why on earth has he got a chicken up there? Well, chickens do fly. I've got a chicken out there because we now know quite a bit about human expertise, and we know that one of the key things that we now know is that experts see things other people don't. So an expert is tuned into certain fine perceptual discriminations in their field. And chicken sexing is a great example of this because until about the 1930s, nobody knew how to tell the difference between a boy and a girl, day old chick. Now, this is important because boys, this is probably true of many other species too, are of absolutely no use to anybody. And so it's economically essential to take the boys out of the pool, keep the girls to lay the eggs and so on. In the summer of the 20s and 30s, the Japanese discovered how to do this. Experts can sex 1,000 chicks an hour with almost complete 100% accuracy. The other thing I do have to point out is I just love this anonymity bar that's been placed over the chick. I mean, you never know, you might have come across this chick sometime later on. And how embarrassing it would have been to have been, you know, seen the photograph of you with the bum in the air. You know. All right, so we want to look at critical cues. This work, I'm indebted to Mark Wiggins, who is now himself a grey-haired professor at Macquarie University. First of all, we have to establish what the critical cues in this setting are. So we interviewed half a dozen expert instructor pilots, discovered that there were basically 9 potential weather cues that people relied on. We then did a large internet study over the internet where we had people judge weather situations based on these cues. We found expert novice differences, which is what we wanted to verify. We found that experts tended to have a sort of informal rule of thumb that if 3 or more of the 9 cues had changed significantly, then this was time to make a decision. And finally, with sponsorship from the FAA, we decided to develop a tool that would build on this understanding and see if it would be effective in avoiding, helping pilots avoid some of these weather-related catastrophes. So here's an example. This is from the software. So on the left here, we have the 9 cues that we've elicited from our experts. The videos on the right are demonstrating training people to perceive those cues. So cloud base, we're looking at different cloud bases and how to judge the height of cloud base and so forth. So we get all that kind of training. And then we get, it's no good just teaching people to make a discrimination. You have to learn to apply that discrimination. So in this phase of the program, pilots look at video, in-flight videos, and say where it was in the flight that the weather deterioration occurred. Anyway, this was successfully developed as software, computer-based training for pilots. WeatherWise 2 obviously followed WeatherWise 1, and the whole program was sponsored by the U.S. Federal Aviation Administration, but the software was subsequently distributed in Australia as well as here. And again, we did a validation study where we showed that pilots who learnt these discriminations and learnt to apply them appropriately made better, safer, early decisions in regards to weather than did controls. Now, there's a nice postscript to this, and normally academics assess their impact through citation counts and so forth. This is a from a report by the National U.S. National Transportation Safety Board into a crash that occurred, that aircraft, or at least that aircraft type there, in 2008 that was carrying some tourists in Alaska, crashed into the side of a mountain in poor weather. And the report, NTSB, said it was unlikely the pilot would have flown into the bad weather if he had accurately assessed the changing weather conditions. And furthermore, they went on to say, the NTSB concludes that tailored cue-based training, and they cited our study, could provide an important safety benefit. So having come from iSync's epic irrelevance, I now feel this is what I wanted to do all along. It took me a long time to find it, but this is where I got to. All right, the very final topic I want to talk about. Many of you may remember Qantas 32, it was an Airbus A380 in 2010 that took off from Singapore, and shortly after takeoff had a massive catastrophic engine blade failure. Lumps of metal span out of the engine at phenomenal speed, sliced through flight control surfaces, disabled the hydraulic systems, the electrical systems. This is now a crippled A380. It was this close from being the world's worst aviation disaster. The crew battled to keep the aircraft in the air, and happily it had a successful end. They got the aircraft back on the runway at Singapore. Now, the reason I'm mentioning this at this point is this is the final topic that I want to describe tonight. During this battle with the aircraft, this crippled aircraft, these are electronic aircraft. They generate hundreds of electronic warnings and advisories. And the electronics were screaming at the crew to transfer fuel. The aircraft's fuel was getting unbalanced. The left wing was leaking fuel. The right wing was getting very heavy. The electronic system says, well, you need to correct this imbalance and transfer fuel into the left wing. De Crespoli thought, this sounds familiar. I remember a similar case. This was this Air Transat 767. It developed a fuel leak in the left wing. The system advised the pilots to transfer the fuel. They did. The aircraft ran out of fuel because they transferred it into the damaged wing. Luckily, they just made it onto a nearby runway in the Azores and landed safely. But by remembering this and avoiding this mistake, the captain had demonstrated terrific case-based learning. I mean, we all know that it's a wise person who learns from their own mistakes, but I think an even wiser person learns from other people's mistakes. So this is the whole aspect of aviation safety that we wanted to look at. So this is a print version, but we had an online survey, went out to over 1,000, was filled in by over 1,000 pilots worldwide. We had Israeli fighter pilots, we had US Navy pilots, we had commercial airline pilots, we had student pilots, all sorts of people wrote in and described their case experiences. And over half said, you know what, when something bad happens, I do sometimes think of a case does come to mind. And the source of most of these cases that pilots bring to mind is written material, safety magazines, accident reports, and so forth. So you know, you've probably all watched programs on television, and you might think, oh, I remember seeing that on, you know, Mayday or Air Crash Investigation or something. So we set about studying this. Aircraft accidents are stories. And like any story, they have a background, a setting. They have a challenge or complication. Something happens. There's a resolution of that complication. Something is done. Pilot lowers the nose. Pilot spears into the side of a mountain, whatever happens. And there's an outcome. So what makes stories memorable? Well, one theory is that it's that complication challenge that makes a story most memorable. If you hang your memory around that, it will turn out to be most useful for the widest range of situations in the future. Because at that point in the story, we don't know what yet is going to happen. The fire-breathing dragon has appeared, but how's it going to turn out? So if we remember fire-breathing dragon or ran into turbulence and unexpectedly, then that's a good peg to hang our memory on. And this is predicted by something called the predictive features model. So we ran some studies, we constructed our own aviation safety magazines made up to look like real professional magazines. We tested recall and recognition. We had pilots and non-pilots, and we had the standard ordering versus just various randomized orders of these different features in order to see what contributed most to memorability. And as predicted by the theory, the challenge complication feature was in fact more strongly, was the best feature that led to subsequent better learning. Now, armed with this, we decided to do something practical. This is the New Zealand Civil Aviation Authority's Vector magazine, and in the back of it, it has a series of accident reports. And this is the standard canonical format. It's always headed by information about the aircraft registration, its type and location and so forth. We have determined that the best way of making this memorable is to emphasize and lead with the challenge or the complication. What's distinctive about this case is that it was an icing and countering plan. So we ran a study, we compared the effectiveness of these two formats, and we showed a clear advantage for the reformatted based on our experiments and based on the theory. Now, you remember I told you that our Q-based training had a significant impact and was cited by the NTSB. I'd love to say this research had exactly the same impact on the CAA, but I can't because it didn't, because they just ignored it completely. So for those of you, the students who are thinking of, oh, I'd like to go into this sort of field because you know, I could see how you can make a difference and so on, you win some, you lose some. Sometimes people listen to what you say, sometimes they don't. So finally, just a few exciting things that are ongoing in my lab, and I do apologize to anybody who I've left out of this. Just on the bottom right there, that's a study of flight displays that Stephen Wright recently completed, comparing glass cockpit displays with the traditional counterparts. The top here is a study currently being run by Taylor Shepherd, facilitated by Captain Hugh O'Neill and his colleagues, that gave us access to bridge simulators, and we're studying the interaction and teamwork of people on the bridges of ships. I mean, it's no different from an aircraft. I mean, we've got teams of people carrying out work-related activities, but there are other issues that arise in the context of doing that in any group setting. I'm very excited by this work by Brittany Cullen. It's what you see there is a screen from an application that she's developed. It's to assist in the diagnosis of neurodevelopmental disorders. And what it does is to, it's based on the same sort of principles as our Q-based work in aviation, basically less can be more, that reducing the information and making it available in a particular way can facilitate people's ability to arrive at the right kinds of diagnoses. And finally, at the bottom here, this is a graphic from Rachel Goh's work on using a luggage detection paradigm to study some of the other factors that influence communication and willingness to report detection items. This wonderful graphic was, the whole thing was set up by the wonderful Russell Phillips, to whom we're deeply, deeply grateful, and the work's been co-supervised by Brent Alsop and myself. Right, I say that behind every successful man is a surprised woman. My case, a completely flabbergasted family, here receiving the news of my promotion. Thanks, guys. It really did just come into relief for me just how important other people are and all these things. These are just hope. Almost all students that I've worked with, postgraduate students that I've worked with over the years, I'm bound to have missed somebody out, and if I have, I'm very, very sorry indeed. There are many other special people too, some of whom are here tonight, colleagues, friends, people I've worked with, people I've talked with. The outstanding technical the staff of the department make all this work possible. I don't want to pick out people individually, but I will. I have to thank I have to thank Cara for helping me with some aspects of the presentation. I appreciate that. And I guess I have to thank Mike too, because I figure it's also quite a good time to say something positive about Mike since he's speaking next. But it was Mike who got me to apply for promotion. I mean, pretty much a lot of arm twisting was involved. I wasn't really that keen, but Mike pretty much forced me into it and supported me through the entire process. So I would say, if you enjoyed the talk, do feel free to send me an email. If you didn't like the talk, do feel free to send Mike an email. Thank you.
Tenakoto, tenatato, katoa. My name is Mike Colombo. As you know, I'm the head of the Department of Psychology, in which David O'Hare resides. First and foremost, David, thank you very much for an absolutely engaging talk. I remember, we've both been in the department a long time, it was about 20 years ago, you handed me a book and you said, I think you should read this. I think you will find this very, very interesting. And the title of the book was Set Phasers on Stun: Design, Technology, and Human Errors. And it's a collection of stories about how design flaws and technology flaws and human errors lead to some of the biggest tragedies of the 20th century. And it's absolutely a fascinating read. You were absolutely right. A fascinating read. And it was also a very important read, because I recognized after reading that, I thought, I'm really happy that there is somebody in my department that is doing this type of research. It's fascinating and it's important research. And the students get it as well. Over the years, I've been involved in a lot of committees and interacted, obviously, with students in many different contexts. Year 3 project coordinator, I've been on the staff student committee, still am on the staff student committee. I teach, and of course, I was PhD convener for many, many years. And the often heard sentence that I heard from students was, I really like David O'Hare's section. Can we have more of that stuff? So the students get it. And I understand why they get it. David's research is that perfect interface between rigorous science and the application of that science to the improvement of the human condition. In this case, how to make air travel even safer than it is before. Because these accidents, they don't happen because of a single error. They happen because of a multitude of errors that build upon themselves. And you can't look at an accident and point to a single factor and say, that's the reason why it happened. Because it's, again, a multitude of factors that contribute to these accidents. And understanding all the interplay between all these factors is an incredibly difficult thing. And it's something that David O'Hare has done brilliantly for the last 30 years. So thank you very much. And I think you recognize how important that is because, of course, we want to continue to improve air safety. So thank you, David. Thank you very much for all of your research. Thank you for providing an absolutely wonderful and enjoyable talk and for providing us with a personal insight into your personal journey and your research journey to professor. I have here a present that I would like to offer you on behalf of the university and the department for everything that you have done. Congratulations on a very well-earned promotion to professor. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much.